What do I do if I have no idea what I want to do with my life? When I'm in the middle of my career and realize my work doesn't have meaning or purpose to me anymore? How do we tell our friends and family that we want to completely change our career? Where should we start in making such a big life change? And how can I know what to change careers to? This podcast was created to answer these very questions. My name is Travis Robinson, and you're listening to The Everyday Worker.
My name is James Considine. I'm the principal of Scalable Consultant, and my primary focus these days is working with consultants, serving corporate clients to help them scale their businesses from six figures to seven figures and get back some time in life so they can enjoy life outside of work. I am from New York. I've lived in New York most of my life. I grew up near New York City. I went to college in Albany and have just been here ever since. So I live up here in upstate New York with my family. I've got two boys, two dogs, two cats, a beautiful wife, and just love living in this area.
Yeah, awesome. Well, I'm excited to have you on today, James, and I do appreciate you taking the time to be here. So, yeah, thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
So I was doing a little bit of research on you, of course, stalking your LinkedIn profile and whatnot. And so you worked as an operations and continuous improvement leader. That's what it said on your bio. And mm-hmm. You did that for like 25 years.
Yeah.
Could you tell me a little bit more? What does that even mean? And what kind of work is that?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So the way I think about operations in a lot of different organizations, you know, it's really, honestly, it's just getting stuff done. So you think about in, say, a manufacturing company, the operational team is really essentially running the factory, producing the product, making sure that there's supply chain is there to provide materials to the folks building the product and so forth. And so operations is a very tactical, execution-focused discipline, you know, different than, say, engineering, where they're designing and, creating ideas for products and how to manufacture them, or marketing, where you're dreaming up ideas for how to sell things or so forth. Operations is really just in the trenches getting stuff done. And it's a feature of kind of most businesses. So I've done it in product businesses, I've done it in software businesses, I've done it in service businesses. And it's really just the kind of the discipline of getting things done, delivering the actual product or service to end customers.
Is that something that you always imagined yourself doing, or did you just kind of fall into that?
I fell into it. I thought I was going to become a philosophy professor, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was my goal.
Different.
Yeah. Well, I studied philosophy in school, and it's kind of, I wanted to be a philosophy professor, and I actually had a family friend who was a philosophy professor and said, James, don't become a philosophy professor. It's the worst. Don't do it. Which I was just shocked at, quite honestly, that this guy who was a tenured philosophy professor told me not to do it. I actually, even went, got into a PhD program and started it, and it just, I don't know, I was trying to work at the same time. It just wasn't really for me in the end. So I dropped out.
Nice.
And, over time, I started to, kind of lean, sort of get into more project management, sort of execution type roles.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was working for a company that runs the power grid and the power market in New York State, I got introduced to Lean, Six Sigma, continuous improvement, quality improvement. And that really just changed the complete trajectory of my career from then on. Because while I had always been a bit of a try to solve problems, try to improve things, this gave me a pretty powerful set of tools and concepts to really, apply that and solve problems at a much bigger level and have a much bigger impact in an organization. Mm-hmm. And that basically was from 2004, 2005 to last year when I left my corporate life, that was a big feature of everything I did, was those types of tools and approaches.
Yeah. So you study philosophy and you go and you start this PhD program and then you end up dropping out. How did you even make that transition from kind of your whole world is revolving around philosophy to now being able to move into operations? Did someone take a chance on you that, because you may not have had the knowledge or skills yet?
Yeah, it's a great question. So first off, it was actually pretty devastating at the time to kind of walk away from something that I'd really had a lot invested in.
Sure, yeah.
And, you know, in hindsight, you know, I didn't really, I know I was pretty young, I was pretty immature. I didn't really handle it in the best way. I think had I gone and asked for help from, you know, my advisors and things, I'm sure I could have figured out a way to do it, but I didn't do that. I just basically said, "Ah, you know what? I can't do this." And I left. And, so I think, you know, at the time in my early career, I was really, really focused on improving my income as quickly as I possibly could. And so that really meant that a lot of the career decisions I was making were like, what's the next job that's going to pay me more than the one I have now? And that mm-hmm. often meant changing companies. So I changed companies quite a bit in my early career out of college. And, you know, I managed to basically double my income inside of, I don't know, 6-7 years of leaving college. So it wasn't a failed strategy, I would say, but it was probably not the right priority, in all honesty, to let guide my career decisions.
Why is that?
Well, because I think there's certainly more to career fulfillment than having a good salary. I mean, I think that's part of it, but it's not the most important part of it. Mm-hmm. And so I think my own case, jumping from field to field in some respects and jumping from company to company, it made it more difficult to find the next thing, right? So I think people who kind of stay in a function or stay in a field or, you know, a sector of the, you know, the economy or what have you, it can be a little bit easier for them to kind of move from place to place because, you know, they have a functional depth, they have an industry expertise. And not saying that it's a purely linear career path, but it's an easier move than, you know, moving completely from one thing to the other. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people that I actually coach and consult these days who are trying to make a change, what I tell them is if you're going to make a move, the best way to do it is to have one foot in a discipline or an industry or a function, and then move the other foot into the thing you want to do. And so to my earlier point, what wound up happening for me was this continuous improvement work was the thing that was kind of my one foot. And then I used that to parlay into other things. So the story being is like, after I got, you know, certified in Lean Six Sigma as a black belt, I was doing all this stuff. One of my colleagues got a new job and basically recruited me into that company, totally different sector, but it was on the basis of my expertise and strength as a black belt. I did that for a while. Then I moved on to General Electric again, not totally different industry because it was energy, but I moved into a black belt role at General Electric. And then did that for a while, moved into an operations role in General Electric, and then moved to Philips again on the basis of having, this Lean Six Sigma continuous improvement expertise, and moved into medical devices and imaging equipment that I had no background in. So it can be done, right? But if I had wanted to go from, say, marketing and energy to operations and healthcare, that would have been a bridge way too far. But since I had this thread of continuous improvement, it was far easier to then kind of keep that foot in that function and discipline and then move the other foot into another industry.
Interesting. And so let me ask this first. So what challenges throughout your career of doing this operations were, what challenges did you face in your career that you actually really enjoyed?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'll be honest with you. I think a lot of the challenges were around two things, or three things. One was kind of having to lead a project in an area that was something that was kind of a formidable task, let's say. that required a lot of sort of aligning of stakeholders and getting a lot of agreement and negotiating with people, or just difficult content areas to work through. I remember doing a project in GE where I had to work on quality of engineering drawings, of all things. I'm not an engineer, didn't know how to read them, still don't know how to read them. And yet my job was essentially to figure out a way to cut down on the number of errors that were occurring in these drawings. And it was one of these things where, you know, I go around and talk to people and they say, oh, you're working on engineering drawings? Oh my God, we've been trying to fix that for 30 years. Good luck, you know? So I've had a number of projects like that in my career where I've been asked to do, where people be like, oh man, we've been trying to fix that for years. Good luck. And I guess through a combination of naivete, perseverance, and, you know, stubbornness, managed to kind of get through the other side and achieve some, you know, some results and some improvements kind of against my, you know, against my expectations, let's say. I think other challenges have been kind of on a more personal maturity, growth trajectory way, more emotional intelligence, more, you know, dealing with insecurity, imposter syndrome, things that, as you kind of rise in an organization, become far more important and far more impactful than your functional expertise or industry expertise, as you're trying to engage with, influence, lead other people. These sort of emotional things become paramount to sort out. And that was very challenging for me, quite honestly, to be perfectly blunt, challenging to make those leaps sort of mindset wise in order to step into some of these very big roles.
So what, what was I going to ask? Dang it. This podcast is very quickly turning into my own personal information interview with you, because when I was in college and studying engineering, a lot of the classes in engineering that I was taking, they never like I kept expecting one of the topics to like really jump out to me, but it never really seemed like all of them were interesting, but it never was, you know, something that I really wanted to put a lot of time and energy into until I took a business class, and it was production and operations management. And I really enjoyed it. I kind of viewed it as like a puzzle. You know, you kind of, it's like a mystery. You're trying to figure out how you can move things around to make it more efficient and more productive. And yeah. I thought it was pretty fun. You know, I mean, it was just one class that I took, but to me, it seemed really fun. And I'm really curious. So you shared that one example of that project you had. What are some other like projects? What did they kind of look like of what you worked on throughout your career?
Sure. So let's see. I used to work for a company that's now part of Quad Graphics, which does printing and graphics and direct mail, all that junk mail you get, and all the things that are stuff your Sunday newspaper. I don't even know if anybody gets a newspaper anymore, but but I worked on things like that. You know, where I worked with a group of people that were essentially retouching photographs for use in printing catalogs and websites and things like this. And so it was a very interesting kind of way to look at it from a process perspective, because there was so much judgment and craft and almost art involved in what they were doing. And you know, our job was essentially to try to get more quickly to the result that a customer would accept. And instead of kind of endlessly going back and forth, well, can you fix this? Can you fix that? Because all that costs money, and that, you know, kind of not only costs money for the company that we were serving, but also costs money for us. So that's just one example of things where I found, you know, over and over and over again, where people may think, oh, you know, well, what I'm doing isn't a process. It can't be a process. It's too, like, whether it's salespeople or people in legal, believe that what they're doing is so, kind of created every single time that you can't possibly create systems and processes around standards around it in order to not only make it more efficient, but make it easier to do, make it more enjoyable for workers to do and so forth. Yeah. So I found that to be pretty common throughout is this idea that, things are not processes. I mean, the truth of the matter is if you can't really describe in sequence or what steps are required in order to do something, then you probably don't have a process. And honestly, you probably don't know what you're doing, or you can't repeat what you're doing, right? Another project that I worked on, when I joined Philips, this was an interesting situation. I was actually hired and my position was funded in order to solve a massive problem. And I had already been given a financial goal to hit for the following year before it even started. And it had to do with how we shipped and installed magnetic resonance imaging equipment in hospitals around the world. So a bit of context, when you install a magnetic resonance imaging scanner, an MRI machine, mm-hmm. it's essentially a truckload, literally a semi tractor trailer truckload full of stuff in order to get that thing working, right? And secondly, everyone is different because the sort of requirements or the conditions at every site are different, right? And the third thing mm-hmm. is that by the time that you put this together, the first time it's ever been assembled as a complete unit is in the field at the customer's location. Jeez. So unlike other types of products where you may put it all together, test it in the factory, test it in the lab, then take it apart and ship it to a customer, this was essentially being manufactured in the field.
Yeah.
By the way, it is also, these are superconducting magnets that are full of helium. And there's kind of like a black magic involved in kind of getting these things to work. And so I joined Philips. I'm brand new. I don't know anything about medical devices. I don't know anything about MRI. And my boss is like, okay, so your job is now to help us save 8 million euros next year by fixing this process. So go to it. it was daunting to say the least. It was daunting to say the least to just sort of get my head around this and start to figure it out. And I was very fortunate that I had a guy working for me who was a brilliant guy, and he knew a lot about this, and he totally saved me. I got to say, he totally helped me out. And he was a guy who worked for me. So I will say that, no matter who it is that you're looking at, if there is a smashing success to talk about, they definitely had help. And if they don't acknowledge that, then, that is a bit lacking in integrity from my opinion. So not only did you have like the technical aspects of things, that there was all sorts of organizational aspects of things and financial aspects of things. And it was just a huge, complicated thing to unravel. And, fast forward a couple of years later, we wound up, saving tens of millions of euro doing this, dramatically cutting the amount of time that it took to put these things out in the field. And several other parts of the company were taking the things that we developed and applying them in their businesses as well. So what started out as something I never could have imagined I would succeed at and lost a lot of sleep over turned out to be, a sort of best practice project outcome that the rest of Philips took up and adopted.
So in this type of industry of working in operations, are you moving around a lot to different companies? Like are they hiring you to figure out a specific project?
Yeah. So there's a couple of ways that this happens. So what more often than not, you have people like me who were in continuous improvement, who were working alongside the folks who actually ran the factories, ran the operational teams. And so there can be definitely some movement between companies in that discipline, because they may decide, well, you know, we're going to hire a bunch of experts. They're going to train us up. They're going to teach us how to do this. And then once we figured it out and we trained up all our staff, then we'll just kind of sustain it and we don't need the experts around so much anymore. And then they move on to the next company. The other way that this is done, and a lot of companies are moving in this direction, Toyota is probably the best example of this, where they don't necessarily have experts outside of operations helping them kind of work on improving things and fixing problems. They basically instill it as just part of the job. And so everybody learns how to do it. And there are no sort of quote unquote senseis or black belts or anything like that. It's just, if you're running a factory, you are expected to understand this and take responsibility for improving quality in your product, including improving quality in your process and your productivity. And it's just expected that that's part of your job. And those folks, you know, there is definitely some movement from plant to plant, from industry to industry, but, you know, folks who tend to be in one flavor of manufacturing, whether it's aerospace or medical devices or automotive, tend to kind of stay in those fields because there are some fairly unique features, you know, not just sort of process wise, but regulatory wise that you need that expertise in as well.
Awesome. So I'm curious, before we move on to talking about your coaching and kind of how you moved into the coaching consulting side of things, for someone that does want to get into operations, and I'm really curious to hear from you, since you moved into operations without having had that education in college. You did philosophy, and so you kind of had to transition over to it. What would be, in your opinion, like a first step that someone could take to start moving into the operations industry?
That's a good question. In some ways, it depends a little bit from where you're moving. I think if you're in engineering now, it's like if you're in design engineering, say, you know, mechanical design engineering, a lot of those folks kind of go into manufacturing engineering. My honest opinion is, if you're in a role like that and you started showing up in the factory just to, like, you know, kind of see what people are doing and learn from them, that would be welcome, because my experience with a lot of the folks who are designing things that get built don't spend much time actually watching how they get built and how they get made. And so, they wind up designing things that look great in the computer on the CAD drawing, but, you know, when you go to actually try to build it or supply, you know, get sourcing and products, parts for it, it's way harder than it is on the drawing. So I think that, you know, going in with sort of a sort of respectful, appreciative inquiry view to learn what's going on in operations, not to kind of tell them what to do from an engineering perspective, will earn you a lot of good grace and goodwill from the folks there. And then, and I think there's probably other functions too, where they tend to not perhaps be as integrated or spend as much time in the operational world versus their own silos, and would be welcome if they approached with the idea that they were there to learn and there to help. That could be extremely useful, because what winds up happening a lot of times in operations is that the operations team kind of has to live with problems that are created elsewhere. And you know, when push comes to shove, it all rolls downhill. Where you see it the most is the culmination of all these problems is a product being defective, a product being late, what have you. And so if you're in another function and you want to get closer to it just by kind of involving yourself and learning about what's happening there, and then starting to become a resource or an advocate in your functional area to help solve some of the operational issues, goes a huge way. A huge way to start to get your feet wet into what's going on there. And honestly, I think if you're in a position where you have created goodwill with operational leaders, very likely to want to take a chance, not even take a chance, but give you an opportunity to kind of work with them, right? So bit of a long answer, but that's my suggestion for how you go about it if you're really interested in that.
Is it important, do you think, or critical to get like a Lean Six Sigma certification, or I don't know what exactly certifications are called, but...
Yeah, I think it's helpful to have experience with it. And honestly, there are some places where you can get certified, quote unquote, I'm making air quotes here, without actually having to show application in a real business environment. So you can basically go to, you know, Villanova or OSU or any number of programs and kind of get yourself a certification. But in my opinion, if you have not demonstrated, and I wouldn't actually hire somebody as a, you know, as a senior person in this world, unless they demonstrated that they have actually gotten results in a real business environment, right? Because the theory is one thing, but application is everything when it comes to any of these concepts, right? Because you're dealing with people and you're dealing with change management. You're dealing with essentially leading people through changing what they do. And again, like my earlier example with the engineering drawing looking perfect, but the product being impossible to produce, it's the same thing. Like you could pass all the tests with any, you know, in any certification, but unless you can demonstrate application in a business environment, it's not terribly worth very much, in my opinion.
So I want to move on a little bit to your coaching and consulting. How did you end up getting into what you're doing now?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, you know, I wound up choosing to leave the corporate world last year rather than relocate my family. And it was kind of exploring things I could do to kind of create something for myself, and decided that rather than kind of putting out my shingle as a continuous improvement consultant, which is a fine choice. It just takes longer when you're, you know, kind of working in that world to get contracts and projects with companies than to just work with individuals. And so one of the things that was part of all of my roles in continuous improvement, particularly, was coaching and mentoring. And when I was leading teams later as an executive, coaching and mentoring was a big part of what I did. And so, you know, over the years, I've worked with hundreds of people on their careers and helping them get jobs and helping them get through that. So it seemed like a natural segue for me to start working with individuals in a coaching practice. And so that's what I decided to do and put something together, a program in the fall of last year, and started enrolling people in it in January and working through their job searches together.
Nice. What would you say is one of maybe the biggest life lessons that you've personally learned through either the operations side of your career or the more recent coaching and consulting?
Yeah. So I think a couple of things. I mean, I think, you know, when it comes to operations and in my roles, my job first and foremost was generally to be a sort of an agitator or a catalyst or a force for change in of some sort. And so I think, you know, what I've learned is a couple of things. One is that people love change as long as it's their idea. And they don't really like having change imposed upon them. Yeah. So the, you know, and it's not always pull out the guitar and play Kumbaya all the time, but but there is a lot to be said for engaging people and involving them early. And the other thing that's a big part of Lean is that it's really incumbent on leadership to work with folks who are closest to the work to generate the ideas for improvement and lead that. Because, you know, what I found in that setting and other settings in my career is that there's just too much to know. There used to be that, you know, if you knew the most in a team or a function, you would become the manager. Mm-hmm. And you could do everybody else's job as well or better than them. And that's how you became the manager. The truth is today, in my opinion, is that things change so fast and so often that and so much that there's just no possible way for a leader to know everything about anything, quite honestly. And so you really have to actively engage and actually set the expectation of people that they have to be involved in creating the future state. Not that it's nice for them to do or they get brownie points for it, but no, it's just part of your job. Part of your job is to make your job better. So that was a big kind of learning for me that it's far better to sort of start there and build engagement than to try to come in and command and control things, because that's when you get people pushing back, right? And you just don't want that. The other thing I learned too along the way is that you always have, you know, there's something called an adoption curve. So you always have early adopters like the people in 2007 that camped out and spent, you know, $700 on an iPhone that, you know, was revolutionary at the time, but now it's kind of laughable, right? When you think about what the first iPhone did. But there's always those people that are on the leading edge, they get the newest thing, and they're very interested in trying new ideas. And then kind of all the way on the other side of the curve are people who are still got their flip phones, right? And they're just never going to get a smartphone. And I think there's a tendency when, at least, you know, I saw it and I've, you know, experienced it myself, there was a tendency to really focus in on the naysayers and the detractors and really try to change their mind when you had huge groups of people who are willing to try something new, right? And so rather than letting all of the stubborn naysayers kind of consume all the oxygen in the room, what I started to do was I would really just kind of focus on the early adopters and work with their energy and their passion and their drive to go change things and kind of leave the detractors off to the side for a while and not really pay attention to them. Because they weren't going to do anything except complain and get in the way anyway. And then over time, when you kind of showed them, you know, some success and some results, it became a little bit easier to work with them and kind of to kind of help them become more supportive of what you were trying to do versus starting with them and trying to, you know, get them on your side. So those are a couple of things that, you know, just been sort of practically useful in thinking about how to drive change and lead change in these environments.
Yeah, it's interesting. Just when you kind of, when I think of operations, you know, you typically think of improving and changing a process or how, like a manufacturing process, but it's easy, I guess, to forget about that there's people in those processes or behind those processes and having to be able to work with them and be strategic in how you can successfully implement those changes. Cause yeah, I think it's a skill, such a big, hard skill to develop, to be able to successfully help people to feel like that they are a part of the change and that those ideas are coming from them as well. So that they can support that change, right?
Well, people will always support what they create.
Right.
And so you involve them in creating it. It's theirs. And then you don't need to worry about how are you going to get adoption? How are you going to get people to go along? How are you going to get people to sustain it after you make the change? If they feel like they own it and they actually do own it, then you kind of don't need to worry about that so much.
Yeah. With people that you work with in your coaching and consulting, what's one of the biggest challenges that they face, and what advice do you typically give to them to help them overcome that challenge?
I would say probably the biggest challenge that most people I work with, regardless of whether it's people looking for their next job or in their careers or building a business, is mindset and limiting beliefs. And, you know, just kind of getting in their own way from a mentally, right? That I think is the biggest issue. So for example, in job searching, this can be really critical. you know, when I first started out, I had a number of discussions with a guy who, you know, was an operations guy, had worked in factories for many, many years. When we were talking, he told me that he was 65 years old, probably three or four times. Just kept bringing it up. And I said, you know, it sounds like that you think that this is an issue. And you know, he said, well, yeah, isn't it? And I said, well, only if you make it an issue, right? Hmm. And I think this is the key for people who are in interviewing situations and networking discussions and so forth, is that by and large, when people meet you, at least my experience has been, people give you the benefit of the doubt, right? And if you're harboring these limiting beliefs, they kind of come out sideways, or, you know, sort of whether you want them to or not. And then they start to create doubt in others where there is no doubt. Mm-hmm. And so my advice to him was like, look, man, you know, there are definitely going to be people that are going to say you're 65, that you're not a fit for us. And there are other people who are going to say, thank God we have somebody here who's as experienced as you are. That's exactly what we need. And I strongly believe there are both out there. And it's just a question of cultivating a belief that, this is not a bug. It's a feature for some companies. And it just becomes a question of going out and connecting with those companies. But if you have this limiting belief that, oh, no one's going to hire me because fill in the blank. I don't have an engineering degree. I didn't go to a good school. I don't have a master's degree. I'm this, I'm that, I'm whatever. That is going to basically cut off possibilities to you. And it's going to sort of pollute the opportunities that you do have, because you bring those limiting beliefs to these engagements and these interactions. And on some level, people pick up on them.
Yeah. Well, I think in like every interaction we have with people, whether it's friends, family, or somebody interviewing us for a job, we're always creating some sense of reality around us. And by having those negative thoughts about ourselves, it creates that negative reality and puts us in a bad light. It's like when I see people who like have made me dinner before or something, and when they're bringing their beautiful dish to the dinner table, and before anybody even touches the food, the person who made it she would be like, oh, I don't know. It, you know, probably doesn't taste good. And I might've overcooked it. And like right off the bat, before anybody even tastes it, that person is like already making excuses for why it's going to be horrible. And I feel like we do that a lot for ourselves. Like you said, that for that example of the guy being like 65 years old, that we're so quick to think that we need to make excuses for ourselves. And I think all that does is put us in a negative light and just create a poor reality around us, and kind of puts us in a victim type of mindset.
I could not have expressed that any better. I could not have expressed it better. That is totally, totally true. And it's, you know, I think if you ever read, you know, Marshall Goldsmith, you know, What Got You Here Will Get You There. That's a really good book, by the way, definitely worth reading. That's one of the things he talks about, is that like people, like there's a number of things that he talks about that are essentially things that you need to fix if you're going to get to the next level, wherever, your career, what have you. And one of the things he talks about is taking a compliment, right? So, you know, to your point, like people will be like, you know, even if, you know, in the example you just gave, even if that person didn't say that, you eat it and you're like, oh my God, this is the best thing I've ever had. Oh, really? Oh, you know, I thought I overcooked it and this and that. I don't know. I've made it better before. And his advice is just shut up and say thank you.
Yeah.
just stop it. But it's so hard for people to just shut up and say thank you sometimes. So yeah, totally, totally get that.
Well, I think it's easy to think that you have to be humble means you have to bag on yourself,
right?
And think that you're not something worthwhile. And I think people view that as humility, which is, you know, something that is an awesome attribute to have. But I don't think just telling yourself that you're trash is anything near what humility is.
No, I totally agree. In fact, you know, I've had people say to me directly, they're like, look, man, you know, if you say negative things about yourself to other people, they're going to believe them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're kind of, like I said before, you're kind of putting those ideas in their head where they aren't there.
Right.
And just to be careful about that, right? That that you can sort of create those problems for yourself just you know, sort of by accident. And I think, you know, what I've always been taught about humility is just being the right size. You know, it's not being too big, but not being too small either. Just being the right size and just being truthful is probably the best definition of humility I've ever seen. And I think people I respect and admire who are, I consider to have humility, embody those and display those types of values and that behavior.
Yeah. Well, I've always viewed humility too as something that it's almost as if, I mean, there's lots of different aspects of humility, but one thing that I view is that you give credit where credit is due. And you give credit to your team or whoever, you know, has been involved with whatever project you've been working on, and giving that credit and praise to other people as well, as opposed to taking it all for yourself, and vice versa, giving yourself credit when you deserve credit, in a humble way, of course. But I think that it's just, I don't know, we're bad at giving ourselves credit for the things that we do. You know, it's easy to, like me, I look back on my day and it's so easy for me to look at what I didn't do as opposed to what I have done that day.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, an old adage that I was taught some time ago, as a manager, is basically when you're talking about your team, it's like this, it's like, you guys did a phenomenal job. We need to do better. And I made a mistake, or I was wrong, in that order. And again, I've always really respected and admired leaders that kind of behave that way, that recognize that, you know, part of being the leader sometimes is to kind of raise your hand and take it for the team and basically, you know, kind of take accountability and responsibility for your entire team. And, you know, I've definitely seen leaders that don't do that, that basically, you know, kind of put their team, in front of them to protect them, so to speak, and mm-hmm. and don't take that, you know, accountability and responsibility. And what winds up happening is that people pay attention to that. They absolutely pay attention to that, and you only need to do it once, and then you basically have, you know, kind of communicated to everybody how you are, and you know, honestly, that you're not trustworthy. So that's. That, you know, I think, you know, kind of humility plays into it, because if you're humble, right, and you are kind of right sized, then I think you can have some, you know, I guess, strength of character. We're like, look, if I messed up and I say I messed up, that's far more important than trying to, you know, cover my rear end and sort of try to deflect blame and what have you. And I think it's usually it's like that old saying, it's like the cover up is always worse than the crime, right?
Yeah.
And so if you just kind of, yep, you're right, I screwed up, I messed this up, that's kind of the end of it. But if you start to scramble and try to cover it up or deflect blame or whatever, it just gets worse and worse and worse. And, you know, honestly, that's one of the reasons why, you know, I've kind of left corporate life behind, because there was a lot of that. Quite honestly, there's a lot of that that goes on there for various reasons.
This is a topic that I could talk about for a long time. I really enjoy these types of topics, but we're not going to keep this too long. So I have one more question for you, but if people want to find more of your content or connect with you, where can they go?
The easiest way to find me is on LinkedIn. Yep.
Okay.
Just look up James Considine. I don't know how many there are, but I'm very easy to find, and all my contact information is there.
Cool. Yeah, and I'll make sure to put a link to your LinkedIn on my website for this episode.
Awesome.
So for my last question, and I like asking all my guests this, what does it mean to you to have a fulfilling career?
That's a great question. I think, you know, for me, playing to my strengths in an environment where I can have a meaningful impact on people at large is the highest, you know, kind of highest degree that I could hope for from a career satisfaction and career success fulfillment perspective. And, you know, when I'm not able to do that, you know, in my career, I haven't been happy. I haven't felt fulfilled. But when I have been able to do both those things, it's been amazing.
James, thanks so much. I appreciate your time today. And this was a great interview. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Travis. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it as well.
Thanks for listening to another episode of The Everyday Worker. If you want to find more great content just like this to help you in your career change journey, go to everydayworker.com. There you'll find my blog, all my podcasts, and other free resources such as my Career Change Masterclass, where I share what's stopping you from switching to a fulfilling career and how you can overcome those challenges. Again, go to everydayworker.com to learn more.